Why, hello there. It gives me great pleasure to be speaking today with Dr. Alyssa Rankin, who's a New York Times bestselling author of Mind Over Medicine, as well as The Fear Cure and The Anatomy of a Calling. Welcome, Dr. Rankin.
Please call me Alyssa. Dr. Rankin's my dad.
And maybe we can start by you telling us a little bit about your story and how you came upon the journey that led us to meet a couple of years ago.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a long story. I wrote a whole book about it called The Anatomy of a Calling. But I'll give you an abbreviated response so that we can talk about other things, too. You know, I was, like you, Tamea, I was a very conventionally trained medical doctor. My dad was a doctor, so I grew up around hospitals. I felt called to medicine very young. I was 7 years old, and so I intended to become a doctor my whole, you know, childhood, and went through the system in the very conventional way with, you know, the sort of ivory towers of academia at universities like Duke University and Northwestern University. And I think back to, you know, 30-year-old Lissa coming out of my medical training. And I was very arrogant. I was very certain about how the world works and how the body works. And I felt very proud of my knowledge. And I'm 47 now. So 17 years later, I am continuously humbled by how much I don't know and how much my worldview has expanded and how much the universe has kind of put me through the ringer. As far as humbling me in the face of the mysteries of the universe. And that all really began to come into my awareness about 10 years ago. And after I had been in practice as a full-time OBGYN for about 8 years, and I was increasingly disillusioned, increasingly unhappy with the way my work was going and the way my practice was run. I was in a group practice, and I was a full partner, but I was outvoted by my partners at pretty much every business meeting, because when I started my practice, I was expected to see 25 patients a day, and by the time I quit my job in 2007, I was expected to see 40 patients a day, which meant that I was, you know, double booked in 15-minute slots, and so a lot of my patients, I only had 7.5 minutes, and it felt increasingly like an integrity violation. It felt like I was selling my soul for the security of a paycheck and the stability and status of, you know, a job as a doctor. And my husband at the time wasn't working, and I was the full-time breadwinner for the family. I was pregnant with my daughter, and I had some experiences at work that, again, sort of pushed me to the edge of my own integrity, where it was ultimately, it came down to an integrity breach that I won't get into the details of, but the details are in The Anatomy of a Calling, if you're curious, where it really came down to me choosing between what was right in my heart and quitting. And I had had an experience about a year before I quit that kind of warned me of what was to come, and I had become... First of all, I was taking 7 medications for a whole host of chronic health conditions that my doctors assured me I would need to be on those drugs for the rest of my life. I was having all kinds of cardiac problems. And then I was becoming increasingly depressed to the point of being suicidal. I had some things happen at work that just kind of pushed me over the edge. And I was in my third trimester pregnant with my daughter when I was feeling really suicidal after a 72-hour call shift, and I was exhausted, and something had happened at work. And I was literally on my knees in tears and in prayer, and I heard this little voice that said, "Sweetheart, you're going to have to quit your job." And it was very confusing. I wasn't used to hearing little voices. I didn't understand what was happening, and I thought I was going crazy on top of being suicidal, and I immediately started arguing with the little voice. I said, "No, that's not possible. I can't quit my job." And I started giving the rational list of all the reasons that I had to keep my job. And the little voice said, "You don't have to do anything about it right now. You just have to make peace with what's true." And I felt my whole nervous system calm down. And I was able to go to sleep. And I woke up the next day with just this certainty that the little voice was right, that the voice was speaking truth, that my job, or maybe not so much my job as the repetitive integrity violation of working within a system that felt like it was making me choose between doing the right thing for my patients and aligning with my soul and, you know, keeping my job. That became increasingly obvious to me that the little voice was right, and that I was at some point going to be at the edge of choosing to leave my career, which I did in 2007. And I had no idea what I was supposed to do next. I had no backup plan. I had no money aside from, you know, I sold my house and liquidated my retirement account in order to just fund our lives for a couple of years before I wound up taking a job in Mill Valley in Marin County in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I took a job at an integrative medicine practice where I had the blessing of having a whole hour with my patients, which you can imagine the difference between 7.5 minutes and an hour as far as the joy in my own soul. And I had become very curious over those 2 years of being on sabbatical, where I became very much in inquiry about what really predisposes the body to illness and what really makes it healthy. And, you know, I had sensed that there was a great deal more to the healing process than what I had been taught in medical school, but I really didn't know what that was all about. And then I started working with a very unusual patient population, because for those of you who know Marin County, it's filled with health nuts. So they had had the best of Western medical care from Stanford and UCSF. Plus, they were taking 20 supplements, and they had seen their naturopath and their acupuncturist, and they were eating their raw vegan diet, and they were working out with their personal trainer and doing yoga and meditating, and they were some of the sickest people I've ever seen in my life. And they had a laundry list of those kinds of chronic health conditions, Tamea, that you and I know well from being doctors, that when we see the list of these kinds of conditions, like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia and Lyme disease and chronic pain syndromes and, you know, gastrointestinal disorders and these kinds of things, where they had maximized everything that Western medicine had to offer, and these patients were really suffering. Mm-hmm. And so I felt kind of helpless, because, like, everything that was already in my toolbox had already been used and had failed. And so I started just asking my patients really good questions. I just started saying things like, what does your body really need in order to heal? And what is your body saying no to? And what would it take to live a life that your body would love? And invariably, my patients would start crying. And then they would look at me with these sort of scared eyes, and they would say something like, I'm going to have to leave my toxic marriage, or I'm going to have to quit my soul-sucking job, or I need to finally go to art school and, like, fulfill that dream that I've had since I was a little girl. And then they would instantly say, wait a minute, but I can't do that. But some of my patients started getting really brave, and they started actually taking action on the things that they had spoken to intuitively about what their body needed in order to heal. And I started witnessing some of my patients having all of their symptoms going away. And I didn't really understand what was happening, because I wasn't doing anything. I was just talking to them. Mm-hmm. So I started researching spontaneous remission, which is, you know, a term used in the medical literature. And I came across a database at the Institute of Noetic Sciences called the Spontaneous Remission Project, where they collected over 3,500 case studies from the medical literature, from doctors reporting on these sort of mystery cases of people who had seemingly incurable illnesses, who conventional medical therapy had nothing to offer them, or they had already failed conventional medical therapy, or they opted out of it, and then they had this quote-unquote spontaneous cure. Mm-hmm. And I got really curious when I was reading these, because none of the doctors were specifying, like, well, what did the patient do? I wanted to know, like, what happened? And Kelly Turner, who was doing her PhD thesis at the time at UC Berkeley, got curious about the same thing. And she started doing her thesis on people who had quote-unquote spontaneous remissions from stage 4 cancer. And she started interviewing those patients as well as the often the sort of alternative healers who were facilitating their healing journey. And she wrote a wonderful book with the results of her research called Radical Remission. And I wrote a book called Mind Over Medicine that was about the scientific proof that the body is naturally equipped to heal itself, and that there are certain kinds of interventions, certain things that we can do to facilitate the body's natural self-healing mechanisms. And that book got a lot of attention. They turned it into a PBS special, and I ended up leaving my integrative medicine practice because I was on the road and traveling and touring, and people were asking me at the time, like, how do I find a doctor like you? And I really didn't know anybody who was practicing the way that I had been practicing. And so I started the Whole Health Medicine Institute as a training program for physicians and other healthcare providers who were interested in raising consciousness in healthcare and bringing this kind of intuitive approach to the body's self-healing process through kind of combining science and spirituality and bringing these mind-body practices that have been in the medical literature as well as kind of promoted in the world by pioneers who became our faculty, like Rachel Naomi Remen and Bernie Siegel and Larry Dossey and Christiane Northrup and some of these kinds of really pioneering physicians, as well as, you know, bringing in shamans like Martine Prechtel and psychologists and spiritual leaders who were bringing in the wisdom traditions and many of the other forms of healing that have been practiced for millennia by the shamans and the medicine men and women of the indigenous tribes and things like this. So that's the beginning of the story. Like I said, there's all kinds of mysterious twists and turns and mystical, magical moments, but I won't get into those because they're in the book. I met you, Tamea.
Yes, and we learned the six steps that you developed in terms of the six steps of healing, and maybe you can touch upon the steps that we use in the program.
Sure. Well, I should turn that back around you and quiz you on.
That's right.
but I won't. Yeah. So, you know, mind over medicine, like I said, it's all based on scientific data. So this isn't these six steps to healing yourself are not something that I just pulled out of thin air. They're all evidence-based, and all of the really grounded science that demonstrates that these six steps are related to the healing process is all in mind over medicine. But essentially, the six steps are: step one is about believing that cure is possible. So, you know, a lot of us have these limiting beliefs, and they're perpetuated by the medical system. Our doctors tell us your disease is incurable, and then, you know, the mind takes that in as truth. So what I discovered from my research on spontaneous remissions is that if even one person has had a spontaneous remission from the disease that you're suffering from, it is not incurable, and that even just one crack in that belief system can start to open up a portal of potentiality, of possibility. And we know this is related to some of the data on the placebo effect. We know, I define the placebo effect, by the way, as a combination of positive belief and the nurturing care of an open-hearted healer. And so step two is about support. It's about finding the right support through what I call your healing roundtable. And that may include a doctor, a naturopath, a therapist, an energy healer, your best friend, your grandmother. It's kind of a misnomer. We say the body can heal itself, and that's technically true, but most of us can't do it alone. So it's a paradox. It's like the body is naturally equipped with self-healing mechanisms. And we know this. We know the body makes cancer cells every day. We know we're all being exposed to bacteria and viruses and fungi, and most of us aren't getting infected. We know that, you know, proteins break down and the body knows how to repair these broken proteins. We have natural sort of anti-aging techniques sort of built into our systems. But the thing that I didn't really realize in my medical training is that these natural self-healing mechanisms only function when the nervous system is relaxed, when it's in the parasympathetic nervous system or the sort of homeostatic state of the nervous system that Herbert Benson at Harvard called the relaxation response. And most...
I just returned from his course, actually.
Oh, you did? His research has been phenomenal, and I include a lot of his research in Mind Over Medicine. He was one of the pioneers looking at, for example, the effects of meditation on the healing process. And mm-hmm. he researched almost every condition you can think of. He demonstrated that the technique, which is based on a type of transcendental meditation, his relaxation response-inducing technique was shown clearly in his research to benefit almost every condition you can think of. So he really was one of the pioneers. But most Americans, research has shown that we are in the fight or flight, what Walter Cannon at Harvard called fight or flight or the stress response, which is the sympathetic nervous system, that sort of emergency stress response. But we're in that stress response more than 50 times per day. Now, there's nothing wrong with the stress response. If you're actually in physical danger and your physical body is in harm's way, you're being chased by a tiger, or you're almost in a car accident, that flush of cortisol and epinephrine and all these stress hormones that course through your body and activate the, you know, limbic system in the brain that turns on the hypothalamus that talks to the pituitary gland and spits out all these adrenal hormones, that this is a life-saving mechanism, but We are not in danger of dying 50 times a day, most of us. We're not even in danger of dying once a day, most of us. So most of those stress responses are activated by thoughts or feelings that are being created by the mind's imagination of our worst fears, our worst-case scenarios, and this is putting us at risk of disease. Were you going to say something, Tamea?
No, well, thankfully, we're not running away from tigers.
Right? Thankfully.
But we might be running away from our bosses or our jobs or our spouses or who knows.
Right. And, you know, so whenever the body is in stress response, all those self-healing mechanisms are flipped off. And, you know, in your case, dealing with fertility issues, we also know that all those stress hormones are very toxic to the fertility process. So it's not just self-healing from cancer and heart disease and things like that, but it also has a lot of data linking this concept of sort of this mind-body connection via the state of the nervous system is very much linked to fertility as well. So the third step, so step one is about belief. Step two is about support, about that nurturing care and love and community and social support through whatever healing process you're going through. Step three is about really being able to tune into the part of you that I call your inner pilot light. You might call it your intuition or your soul, but it's the part of you that has an understanding of what it is that the body needs in order to heal more so than the mind. And so this ability to kind of... I'm sorry?
That most of us don't allow ourselves the time to actually be able to listen to this part of ourselves.
Right. Step three really requires that capacity for deep listening to that voice, for example, that said to me, you're going to have to quit your job. And it may not be a voice. It may be a dream. It may be a vision. It may be just a direct knowing. It may show up as a synchronicity, that there are ways that our souls communicate with us in mysterious ways that are very, very helpful. And I've been collecting stories like this for years now of people who knew things they shouldn't know about their own health and about their healing process. And I've been speaking to healers and doctors and such about this too, where healthcare providers knew things that they shouldn't know in ways that protected their patients. So I appreciate hearing those kinds of stories, and I've been collecting those over the years. So that ability to tune in is very much facilitated, for example, by processes like meditation, where we can get quiet enough to deeply listen to the part of ourselves that we're often just running away from. So calming down and quieting the nervous system, moving into that relaxation response so we can start to hear the whisper, because this part of us doesn't tend to yell. It tends to come as that still small voice that some of the wisdom tradition teachers will talk about. So step four is about diagnosing the root cause of your illness. So this is not the same diagnosis that your doctor may give you, right? You're going to have a clinical diagnosis, like, you know, fibromyalgia, or your bilateral tubal occlusion if you're talking about infertility, for example. And this is about really, really looking at a deeper level. So, for example, let's say we're all in a room, and there's 100 people in a room, and the strep bacteria is in that room. Now, we know if somebody gets strep throat, we know that the strep bacteria is responsible for causing that strep throat, right? So that's the clinical diagnosis. But let's say there were 100 people in the room and only one person caught the strep bacteria. So why was that one person susceptible that day? That's more the kind of question that we're talking about when we're talking about step four. So I was explaining this to somebody who had strep throat, so that's why I'm using this example. I was talking to this supermodel, and she and I were supposed to meet and do an interview, and then she had to cancel because she got strep throat. And I said, well, let's meet anyway. I'll come to your house and do a house call, and I can explain this process to you there. And so I used that example, and I said, let's go back a few days to when you were probably exposed to the strep bacteria, and let's look and see if there was anything going on that might have put your nervous system in distress response and made your immune system weaker so that you were susceptible to that strep bacteria. And she thought about her calendar, and she went back, and she said, well, actually, you know, my agent was trying to convince me to be a spokesperson for this corporate event, but she said it didn't feel good. I felt like they were kind of asking me to sell out. It didn't really feel aligned with my integrity. And she put her hand on her throat, and she said, but I didn't speak out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was her tuning in to that intuitive part of her, right? And then she was giving me step four. She was saying maybe the root cause of my strep was that I wasn't speaking my truth. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I wasn't protecting myself, and my nervous system was in stress response, which then deactivated my immune response to that strep and made me susceptible. So that's just kind of a simple example. It's not always that cut and dry, and I'm not saying that every illness has a, you know, metaphysical or psycho-spiritual emotional root. You know, I think sometimes it's, you know, I don't know how the universe works, but I think sometimes you're born with a gene, and, you know, you have a symptom because that gene was in your DNA. So I don't think I see sometimes there are some sort of metaphysical healers and teachers that oversimplify this, and I don't think it's quite that simple. But very often when we're looking at chronic illnesses, things that are not responding to medical treatment, they're often when I walk people through this process, they are able to identify often not just one root cause, but multiple root causes that are predisposing them to stress responses in their lives. Maybe it's their job, maybe it's a toxic relationship, maybe it's a financial struggle, maybe it's something going on in their, you know, in their mental health. And so I sort of had a vision of a wellness model called the Whole Health Cairn. And if any of you who are listening are curious to see what that is, I did a TEDx talk called The Shocking Truth About Your Health. And if you Google search my name, Lissa Rankin, with the title of that talk, then you'll find it on YouTube. And it's had a couple million views. It shows the wellness model that this Whole Health Cairn that kind of came to me as a sort of, you know, quote-unquote download. And it's based on data. It's based on scientific data showing that your health is not just related to what you eat and whether or not you exercise and whether or not you have good habits, you know, or bad habits, that it's also related to your relationships and your work and your sexuality and your spirituality and your creativity and your finances and your physical environment and your mental health and how you take care of your body, and that all of those things are related to one another, and there's scientific data linking all of those things to the physical health of the body. And so that model is kind of used in step four when we're training healthcare providers to facilitate this six-step process. We're teaching them how to use that wellness model to help people identify what things in their lives are predisposing them to stress responses and how they might make changes in their lives, in their inner lives and their outer lives, in order to bring the nervous system into relaxation more of the time in order to facilitate healing or facilitate fertility in your situation. So that's essentially what step four is about. It's the most challenging of the steps for most people. And then step five is actually quite simple, related to step four, in that once you've identified what those things that are triggering stress responses are and sort of intuitively tuned into what might bring the nervous system into relaxation response more of the time, then step five is what we call writing the prescription for yourself. And this is just about any actions that are intuitively guided actions. These aren't forced. They don't necessarily come from the mind. They're actions that are intended to make the body ripe for miracles, to basically bring the nervous system into that relaxation response, to improve the possibility of healing, of symptom relief, of fertility, whatever it is that's the struggle that has brought the patient in the first place. And then step six is kind of the most spiritual step of all of them, and it's about surrender. It's about acknowledging that we're not really completely in control, that we're not victims of a hostile universe, we're not victims of our illness, that we do participate. We do have a role. We can be proactive about making changes that will help to put the body into that self-healing relaxation response in the first place. But we're not in charge, meaning there's no guarantees. And I think it can be really easily misunderstood. This process can be misunderstood to suggest that if someone's sick or if they're not getting pregnant, that it's their fault in some way, that they're not spiritual enough, that they're not doing their psychological work enough, and that they're somehow to blame. And that's not what this is about at all. So step six is really about letting go of attachment to outcomes, which is really hard when you're talking to somebody with cancer or you're talking to a woman who's been dreaming about bearing her own children her whole life and, you know, and she's had 10 cycles of IVF and it hasn't worked. So it's a very, step six can also be a very painful but also a very liberating step to just acknowledge that we don't really, you know, we have some control but not full control, and that perhaps there is a force of love, an invisible force of love that has a plan for us, that has kind of, is participating with us as we are participating with our illness or our fertility, and that we can perhaps surrender to that force of love and trust and kind of cast the burden of these attachments that we have to cure or attachments to having our own children or whatever into these arms of love and let go. And this is no small thing. But my theory, my mind always likes to try to explain metaphysical things, but my theory is that in doing so, in being able to really surrender, really let go, that the nervous system relaxes in response to that, because we're like, oh, I'm not in charge. I don't have to keep trying and forcing and pushing myself. And it doesn't mean, it's not passivity. It's not about doing nothing. It's just that from that place of surrender, we are often guided towards actions, and it comes from a very different place. Instead of that sort of desperate, panicked, I got to go to Mexico and go to this, you know, yet another clinic, and I've got to do 10 more cycles of IVF or whatever it is that we might be coming from, that sort of desperate, panicked place, that's going to just activate stress responses. But when we go through that process of letting go, often we'll have, it'll kind of take us back to step three or step four, where we'll suddenly have an intuitive knowing that will then guide an inspired action that's coming from a different place. So it's not about doing nothing, and it's absolutely not about, you know, not using conventional Western medicine. Like, I'm a big fan of conventional Western medicine, and I'm a fan of mind-body medicine, and I'm studying for a future book called Sacred Medicine, where I've been researching shamanism and faith healing and various other types of healing modalities. I think they're all just tools in our toolbox, and we can use them all with a great deal of consciousness. But that sixth step, you and I have spoken about that a lot, Tamea, because I think we see that all the time. I know as an OB and you as a fertility doctor, how many times have we seen those couples that are so heartbroken because all of the infertility treatments have failed and they have not been able to sustain a pregnancy, and they finally give up kind of on their knees in this resignation. It's like beyond surrender. It's like complete despair, like exhaustion and giving up. And then they decide they're going to adopt, and the adoption papers come through, and then they get pregnant. You know, I know I saw that all the time, and it's not like you can decide to sign adoption papers as a way to trick the universe so that you can finally get what you want. It's like when you get to that place where you really are okay no matter how things go, where you're not hustling for your happiness, where you haven't tied your sense of wholeness and happiness to one particular outcome, and you're really okay with whatever the universe gives you. It's almost like something really lets go and the nervous system really relaxes, and that's the situation where we tend to see these circumstances that look miraculous. And I can't fully explain how that happens, but you know, my theory is that physiological explanation of activating those natural self-healing mechanisms. But again, I don't claim to know how the universe works.
Well, this is absolutely fascinating, everything that you've learned and you've described, and I have seen it work with my patients as well, which is what led me then to put together a book about all the different ways that couples can conceive and individuals can conceive, including medical treatment, naturopathic treatments, acupuncture, mind-body tools, counseling, donor sperm, donor egg, because I have seen all of these things and miracles happen in my patients, and I would like to be able to offer them this as yet another way that they can also approach their fertility challenges. And it's fantastic and fabulous and exciting that we did cross paths and that we continue to work together, because I find your work immensely helpful to many patients.
Well, and you know, Tamea, when I first met you, I was so grateful. I was like, oh, thank God, somebody who's doing fertility work, who's open to these ideas, because I know, like, almost more than maybe anything other than cancer treatment, you know, the energy around somebody who's coming in who really, really wants to have their own baby, it's such a place of deep attachment. It's so personal, you know, that especially for those who have dreamed of being parents their whole lives, and they feel often, you know, often those people are also very successful people. They've achieved a lot in their lives. They've been able to kind of control their lives and get what they want. And that that helplessness and hopelessness that can come from feeling like, oh my God, I can't make it happen. Like, the way of being in the world that I've tried and succeeded with my whole life is not working in this one thing. And that sort of painful desperation that can sometimes go into that process. And I feel it. I'm very empathic. So when I was working with my own patients who were going through a fertility treatment process, you know, I could feel that intense pain. So I was so happy to see you in our program and to just offer the invitation of a different way of showing up. And it's a very proactive way. It's not, like I said, it's not about being passive. It's not about not doing IVF. It's not about not doing donor egg, donor sperm, or, you know, these really miraculous, conventional medical interventions to help facilitate this process. But it's coming from that place of inner peace, of like really letting go, of really trusting the process, trusting that whatever outcome comes from that peaceful place is going to lead to its own magic in life, that we don't always know what it is that's going to make us the most happy. And sometimes the process itself of going through a fertility journey can be a huge awakening for people. It can really shatter somebody's story of how the world works and how to get what you want, and it can really start to activate a deeply spiritual process for people of interfacing with the mysteries and the mystery of life, right? The mystery of that which activates life in the world is moving through us as we're interfacing with this whole fertility journey. So I have been really grateful to be able to work directly with you, Tamea, and to help support you supporting other people who are going through this process.
Absolutely. And I would like to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. And I look forward to assisting in the journey of many more couples to come and individuals.
Oh, thank you. And I just want to encourage people that are listening, like, I just want to give you my own endorsement of, I'm so grateful that there are doctors like you who have the mastery and the expertise in the conventional medical techniques who are also open to collaborating with other types of practitioners and, you know, being open to these mind-body approaches and, you know, being available to facilitate this awakening process that can happen for people if they're allowing the fertility journey to be a journey into the mystery. So thank you for all that you're doing, and thank you to those who are listening for being open to this way of experiencing what you're going through. My heart is with you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.